Welcome to Bite Size Human Geography, a podcast meant for students and anyone who wants a better understanding of the world. We investigate global issues using human geography concepts. It's human geography made simple. Hello and welcome. Today we are going to be reviewing one of the units that tends to give human geography students the most trouble, which is the political unit. And I think part of the reason for that is because for a lot of students, this is the first time that you've really had to dive deep into some of this material. The vocabulary tends to be new. You haven't studied it before. And so it can be a challenge for human geography students. So what I want to do today, this is especially for AP human geography students, is I want to go through the course and exam description. Now realize that whether you're in human geography AP or a different human geography class, the content is going to be really similar because obviously AP classes are designed by college professors. So it makes sense that what you're going to be learning is the same thing that AP students are going to be learning. So if you have access to, or if you, maybe I'll put a link in the bottom of the show notes, I want you to go ahead and pull the course and exam description for Unit 4 for AP Human Geography. So I'm going to give you a second to do that. Okay, so now what I want you to do is I want you to turn to section, or to topic 4.1, which was is the introduction to political geography. When you're looking at the course and exam description, what I want you focusing on is not all the stuff on the left-hand side of the document, but focus on the stuff on the right-hand side, the essential knowledge. This is a treasure trove of material for you so you can understand what AP is asking you to know. So the first section of the essential knowledge talks about, it kind of is basically a statement that states are the primary building block of the world. Well, that's great. You need to make sure that you know what a state is and what makes a state. But it's the second portion where the material that you need to be focusing on really is, where it talks about things like nation state. So make sure that you know what a nation state is, what makes up a nation state, how does it differ from a stateless nation. Make sure that you can give examples of stateless nations. Of course, the Kurds would be your go-to for this, or multinational states or multi-state nations. This is all just basic vocabulary. And like you've heard me before discuss, this class is so much about, first of all, being able to understand and define the terms, but then applying those terms. So for instance, one of the terms on here, autonomous. Well, autonomous, if you break it down into its roots, auto, of course, you guys know this means self. And the nomos portion of it means law. So basically, if you're going to translate this, this is means self-law or self-rule or self-control. So countries that we know of as countries and or states, remember, that's the term that you should be using in this unit, not a country, but a state. A state has what's called sovereignty, meaning that they have the right to rule. And they're given the right to rule not only because they're in control of their borders and their territory, which is the hallmark of a state, but also because the international community recognizes them as such. Semi-autonomous regions, on the other hand, these are going to be regions that have some degree of self-rule or self-control. And luckily for you, AP gives you a great example of a semi-autonomous region in the form of American Indian reservation systems. So for all of these, just make sure that you can give proper definitions and examples and realize that this would be a section that would be really great for an FRQ question. There have been several FRQ questions that focus on this region, or on this section of the AP course description, because there is just so much to investigate here. So like always, give an example and make sure that you have a really great definition. So section 4-2, or section 4.2, which talks about political processes, this section discusses basically what makes a state and how states have changed over the course of really several centuries. It talks about the concept of sovereignty, which of course is the ability for a country to control itself, right? Control of its borders and recognized by the international community. It once again brings up the concept of nation state. So remember, a state has sovereignty. A nation state is basically a cultural group, a nation that also has sovereignty. So that would be a really good example of that would be Japan, because ethnically, you have a very ethnically homogenous country, whereas a country like the United States wouldn't be a nation state because ethnically we are not homogenous. We're actually quite heterogeneous. And it also talks about the concept of self-determination, which of course is the right to be able to control your destiny as a country. When you're looking at the second section, where it talks about colonialism, imperialism, independence movements, make sure that you can give examples of this in multiple regions. So let's kind of go back in time a little bit. In the 1800s, there were about 35 countries on the planet, okay? If I were to ask you today how many countries on the planet there are, you can't really even tell me that because it depends how we're recognizing countries. So for instance, is Taiwan considered an independent country? Well, if you're asking some people, they would say absolutely not. But if you would ask other people in other countries, they would say yes. So that's when we talk about what makes a state having that recognition by the international community. But if we were going to go back in time to 1800, 35 countries in the world, then you began to see this rapid, especially in the Western Hemisphere, this rapid movement towards decolonization. It began in the United States, of course, with our independence movement here, and of course, quickly spread because it's a long way from the Western Hemisphere to Europe. Those supply chains, those supply lines, just from a logistic point of view, it's hard to control colonies from so far away. So make sure that you know about the first wave of decolonization. And then, of course, there is a second wave of decolonization that began to occur across the planet. And this was post-World War II. And the really simple reason for that is because colonies are expensive. And Europe did not have money to maintain those colonies post-World War II. And so that's what primarily led to the decolonization efforts, in addition to the countries themselves, the colonies themselves wanting to have the right to self-determination. So now we have about 193, maybe 196 countries on the planet. And so that's a pattern that you guys need to know, that the number of land masses hasn't changed, but the number of countries that we are seeing across the planet is continuing to increase, and it will continue to increase, especially as devolutionary forces become more and more prevalent, as they indeed are. Okay, so topic 4.3 talks about issues like power and how it power is projected over people. It talks about concepts like neocolonialism, and dependency theory would be in there as well with Emmanuel Wallerstein. Sometimes teachers don't teach dependency theory until the development and industry unit. I like to teach it in the political unit just because I think it works so well with the concept of neocolonialism. Emmanuel Wallerstein was a theorist who basically helped to create this concept that the planet was divided into three different areas: core countries, semi-periphery countries, and then periphery countries. And as you can imagine, the core countries would be your MDCs, your more developed countries, where most of the political power and economic strength of the planet was located. Semi-periphery countries were going to be countries that were reliant upon the core countries. They would produce items, they would manufacture items for the core countries, but they also acted as a link between the periphery countries, which are going to be your most lesser developed countries, and core countries. And of course, periphery countries, your LDCs, a lot of resources resided here or do reside here, but the link to our MDCs comes from the semi-periphery. So that's just kind of a short overview of Wallerstein's theories, but you do need to make sure that you know who he is. So if your teacher hasn't taught it to you yet, don't worry about it. That's okay, because I'm sure they will pick it up in development and industry for you. But when you're looking at some of these terms in the course descriptions, so things like shatter belts, you have to know examples. You have to know what a shatter belt is, where you could find one, and of course, Eastern Europe would be a great location. Shatter belt regions are regions that often acted as buffers, especially in the course of something like the Cold War, where you had on the one side, you know, Soviet communism, and then on the other side, you had kind of Western free markets and freedom. And the buffer areas, the areas in between those two, big bipolar world, they were continually having to deal with, economic stress and political stress and uncertainty. So that made those shatter belt countries really economically unstable. And even to this day, you look at some of these regions in Eastern Europe that would fall under that shatter belt, designation. And they just having, even though we're 30 years out now from the collapse of the Soviet Union, these are regions that are still struggling to kind of come into, full embracing of free markets, because it's hard. It's not an easy thing to go from, you know, 50 years or 60 years or 70 years of being controlled by a totalitarian system and then suddenly be like, okay, you're free now. Go build a business. It doesn't work that way. It takes time and you have to be educated on those concepts. So that's going to be that first section. The second section talks about territoriality and basically the link that people have with their culture to their political system. And this would be really good to tie into here, especially things like ethnicity and religion. Moving on to section topic 4.4. If you look at 4.4, especially that first sentence on the where it says enduring understanding at the very last portion of it where it talks about boundaries reflect balances of power that have been negotiated or imposed. That gives you the direction of how this particular section is going to go. This is a section, I would star this. This is a really good section for FRQ material because there's so much to be able to talk about. So you have a lot of terminology here. Relic boundaries, superimposed boundaries, subsequent, antecedent, geometric, and consequent boundaries. These are items that you just need to be able to have a great definition for, but you also have to know the whys of how these borders were created. So for instance, if we're talking about a superimposed boundary, you have to know about the Berlin Conference and the purpose of the Berlin Conference. To talk about the Berlin Conference, and this is something that you should know, this has been an FRQ before. The Berlin Conference, for those of you that don't know, was created in the mid to late 1800s. And this was an agreement that was put upon Africa, the continent of Africa, by European colonizers. And the story of that's a very long one, so I'll break it down to you in about 30 seconds. You had European countries that had been fighting many, many wars on the European continent all throughout the 1800s, which led to massive loss of life. And the people that were in charge at this time realized, you know what, this is really silly for us to fight over the continent of Africa when it's so large. Let's just divide it up. So if you were to Google image search Berlin Conference, you probably would find a political cartoon of a gentleman that looks like he's carving up a cake, but it's in French, it's Africa. And if you were to do a Google image search of the Berlin Conference of like a map before and after, you would find this very famous map where it shows the tribal boundaries of Africa. And you could see there's basically thousands of them. And then you see how the Europeans carved up the continent of Africa. And of course, so many of those tribal boundaries don't match the superimposed boundaries that were placed there by the European powers. So the Berlin Conference, even though this is something that's historical and you know, this is not a history class, the Berlin Conference is important because it does take us into today, because so many of the issues that you see on the continent of Africa have its roots in the fact in how Africa was divided during the 1800s, where you had, tribes that hated each other that were then placed within the same boundary. If I say terms like the 38th parallel or the Berlin Wall or the Iron Curtain, this is another, these are also really great examples of some of the terms that I mentioned before with relic and superimposed boundaries, geometric boundaries. So just make sure that you are aware of those terms and how to apply them, and also just jot down a note to yourself that this could be a really just this great FRQ material from this particular section. Okay, I hope you have your highlighter handy, because topic 4.5 is probably, I don't know, I know I keep saying that this is rich FRQ material, but topic 4.5 definitely is. And I want you to turn to topic 4.5 and look on the far left, where underneath it says suggested skills, scale of analysis, to where it says explain the degree to which. Okay, if you are doing FRQ writing in your class, you know that explain the degree to which is often a FRQ question stem that you will find in multiple different topics. And so the fact that you see that in this particular topic should tell you that this is a really great source for FRQ material. So this is a continuation of boundaries. And the first section, once again, talks, it has a lot of vocab here. So I suggest that you make sure that you know that vocabulary. The second section talks about the Berlin Conference, which we just got done discussing, talks about demilitarized zones, which that should be your go-to example for that should be the 38th parallel, which is the section that divides North and South Korea during the Korean conflict. I want you to drop down, not to the third section, but to the section after that, where it talks about the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, or UNCLOS. This is an important one for you to know. Definitely make sure that you need that you know some of the basic precepts behind the Law of the Sea. The first section, of course, talks about the restriction of territorial seas to 12 nautical miles from shore, which enables other ships to have a right of free passage. So basically, if you have a vessel, you can't, you know, be driving by, or driving, you can't be taking your vessel, let's say, close to United States territory within 12 nautical miles. You don't have to worry about being blown up by the United States Navy. Now, you cannot pollute the fishing waters or discharge your weapons or fish because you don't have that right to do that. So it basically enables free passage, but it also enables a country to be able to control its territorial waters. The second important clause from this is the EEZs, or the exclusive economic zones. And what this does is this recognizes a state's rights to be able to fish or explore or exploit any type of resources from 200 nautical miles out from the shore and really all the way down to the center of the earth, because that's typically how land law works. So make sure, now tying back to that third section, make sure that you can give examples of applying the United Nations Law of the Sea. Especially think about regions like the Arctic. If I were you, I would find a map that shows Arctic claims, so you could see how countries claim different sections of the Arctic. I would make sure that you know how the claims, or there are no claims, to Antarctica look. I think probably one of the most important sections would be that you understand the South China Sea dispute. Sometimes it's called the Nine-Dash-Line Dispute. And I would also make sure that you know about the importance of choke points. Choke points are narrow bodies of water in between two larger bodies of land. And so they would be places like the Panama Canal or the Strait of Malacca or the Suez Canal. And these have incredible geopolitical strategic influence on the flow of goods all across the planet. So these are some items that you should be looking at in topic 4.5. And like always, the understanding the vocabulary is important. You can't do any of this without understanding your vocabulary, but you need to be able to apply the vocabulary with real world examples, especially if you're going to be writing some FAQs about this. Topic 4.6 changes. So we've gone from zooming all the way out to global issues to now we're going to be zooming into regional issues or even local issues. And 4.6 is a section that talks about voting, especially in the United States, voting districts, and things like gerrymandering. So to understand this process of voting, make sure that you do understand, first of all, that a lot of this begins with the census. And the census in the United States is taken every 10 years. It's something that's prescribed in the Constitution for a whole host of reasons. Most importantly, just so we know who is in the country and where they reside. After the census, then what begins to happen is what's called redistricting. Redistricting occurs after a census because what happens is a census shows movement, it shows migration. So for instance, if we're looking at the 2020 census, we know that it's going to show a lot more people have moved to the Sun Belt from the Rust Belt areas of the United States, from the Northeast areas of the United States, and are moving to places like Texas and Florida and so on and so forth. And so when that census comes through, it will show that. Well, because more people have moved there, then that means that those states get more representatives to represent them. And places that have lost population, they may end up losing some of their representatives. Well, once this occurs, those lines, those boundaries of each voting district has to be redrawn. That process of redistricting then occurs. So the flow is census, and then after census, you have the reapportionment, so the balancing of representatives to where the population is now living. Then after that reapportionment occurs, then you have redistricting, so the redrawing of the lines. Well, in the process of redrawing of those lines, sometimes political parties in charge in certain states try and game the system to make it better for them for voting purposes. And this is not a Republican or a Democrat only type of maneuver. Both Republicans and Democrat-run states do this. So then what ends up happening is then you might run into what's called gerrymandering, where you have redrawn a district to benefit a specific political party. And the gerrymandering process and the concept of gerrymandering definitely shows up on the AP exam. It's shown up on FRQs for sure. And it's because there's a lot of good stuff to write about in this particular section. So make sure that you know the process behind it. How does the process of gerrymandering work? How does a state get to a point, or a district get to a point where it's been gerrymandered, and know the consequences of what happens with that, how most of this ends up in courts now, and these districts that are, and even a district that may not be gerrymandered, oftentimes will go before a court to have a judge either, you know, send it back to the states to redraw, or sometimes judges will get involved in drawing those districts themselves, which of course they're not allowed to do because that's the role of the state legislatures to do. Okay, topic 4.7 that talks about the different forms of government governance. What I want to make sure that you do is that you know the difference between unitary states and federal states and confederations, mostly unitary and federal because that's where the bulk of countries on this planet lie. But know that unitary states are states that have much more centralized control. Oftentimes, these were countries that probably had some type of either a theocracy or maybe a monarchy. And so they were used to having a strong, almost authoritarian leader in charge, which meant that all of the state power was centralized in one particular location. Federal states, on the other hand, exist with the disbursement of power. So power is not necessarily concentrated in one particular governing body. It's dispersed. And you tend to see federal states, first of all, with countries that have very large land masses, because countries with large land masses have a diverse view of people, a huge diversity of population, both in ethnicity, in language, in religious practices. And so federalism allows for those differences to basically flourish, to be okay. Whereas in a unitary state, because it's more tightly controlled, those differences of opinion may not be fully recognized. And that's where some of the problems lie in the unitary system. The planet as a whole is moving towards a federal system because it allows for flexibility. And especially as people become much more aware and they get much more tied into tribalism and their ethnicity, and kind of moving away from, you know, big nationalistic leanings and more regional leanings, the federal system is going to become even more important. If you need more information on federalism, I will link at the bottom of the show notes to the podcast I did last season on federalism. All right, moving on to topic 4.8, which addresses devolution. Devolution probably is the keystone to this unit. There are so many different sections of the political unit which tie into devolution. And that's why I think this is always a good bet to make sure that you're prepared for an FRQ question based upon this material. So when you're looking at devolution, I think the important thing to understand is, first of all, the planet is actually moving in this direction towards devolving power. So remember when I told you that we have unitary and federal states on the planet, and the planet as a whole is moving towards a federal system. Part of the reason for the movement towards a federal system is linked to devolution. Countries that have diverse populations are often beset by these forces of regionalism, where you have your political loyalty to a region instead of to the country as a whole. What devolution does, so devolution takes power from the central government and pushes it out to more local authorities. When regions receive that power from the federal government or from the national government, it gives them a sense of, okay, I have some control over my situation, or our region has some control over our situation. We don't feel like we are completely beholden to the national government. We have some flexibility. And so that helps to prevent the country from breaking apart. Because remember, when we talked about centrifugal forces, one of the things that happens with centrifugal forces is countries can fragment or fracture. That process, if devolution doesn't work, if devolving power from the state government or from the national government down to more regional governments doesn't work, then you're looking at the likelihood of balkanization. And balkanization is when a country breaks into smaller and more hostile units. And something to keep in mind is countries, when they break apart, it's never pretty. It's never amicable. It's never something that happens without some type of bloodshed. So devolution is designed to help prevent balkanization. There are lots of examples that you can apply to devolution. The top three that I think you really need to have in your stack to be able to write about on an FRQ would be, first of all, the United Kingdom and Scotland and the process of devolving power out to Scotland. The second would be looking at Spain and what's happening with Catalonia and the ethnic fragmentation that's happening there with Catalonia, and also actually with the Basques as well. And then finally, if you were to look at a country like Canada, even though Canada is a federal system, the devolution of power that occurred in the area in Quebec with the Quebecois is an important example of devolution and the application of it. You could also look at countries like Nigeria as well to kind of think about applying devolution. But your very best bets would be the top three that I gave to you, which the top one for sure is the United Kingdom with Scotland. So always go for the easiest example when you're writing an FRQ. FRQ writing should never be about you trying to show off how smart you are. It should be about you applying the concepts of the class and showing the reader what you know. Topic 4.9 is kind of interesting because it continues the discussion about devolution and it actually gives you examples in the course description, and that's kind of an important point here. If you see examples in the course description, you're going to be asked about those. You have to know those examples, and the APHG people are so nice in the fact that they actually give you examples to study, so make sure that you know those. The second portion of that topic 4.9, challenges to sovereignty, talks about advances in communication, having facilitated devolution, supranationalism, and so on and so forth. The best example here for you would be Arab Spring and the application of Twitter and other forms of social media to Arab Spring, and also, quite frankly, all throughout the Middle East. And even if you were to look over in East Asia for independence movements in East Asia, looking at Hong Kong, this would be the same application, but your best bet here would be Arab Spring. The other two sections of this are kind of zooming out a bit more to supranational organizations. And supranational organizations are when you have several countries that band together and they give up a tiny bit of power for a common goal or a common effort. So you see some examples here in the course description of places like the United Nations and NATO and the EU or ASEAN. These are all really great examples. Make sure that you know how these started and who they affect and who belongs to them. And also know the downsides of these. We know that organizations like the United Nations might have the very best, the best intent on things, but the reality of the United Nations is it doesn't tend to be a super effective organization. Topic 4.10. Luckily, I just did a podcast over this. So the podcast that was published just previous to this one, the previous episode of Bite Size Human Geography, is an episode on centripetal and centrifugal forces. So if you're a little rusty over that material, I suggest you listen to that particular podcast where I go a bit more in depth and I give you some examples of both of these forces. And when you're looking at centripetal and centrifugal forces, make sure that you can apply them economically, socially, politically, and be able to give examples of regions around the world where you might see this. All right, well, that's all the time that we have for today. I hope that you have a better understanding of the political unit. I hope you're able to get some insight onto how to be successful in this unit. And I really hope that you enjoyed the concepts of this unit and can see the larger applications of what you're learning in class to the world around you. Please click subscribe to support this podcast. and get all the latest updates as they happen. And as always, feel free to email me at bitesizedhumangeo@gmail.com with any questions that you'd like answered. Have a great afternoon.